Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The book doctors are in the house with some great ideas for the latest in good books and maybe even an idea or two for holiday gifts. We'll talk about the latest from Dan Savage and short story wizard Alice Munro and the book, What Do You Want to Do Before You Die? Later on this hour, our first installment of a new series on this program called 90 Mile View, which will take us into the lives of some very intriguing people around us. Today, a Kansas City police officer who patrols the neighborhood where she grew up. But first up, the book doctors. They are Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. She's a freelance writer, editor, and reviewer. Jeff, always good to have you.
Nice to be here, Steve. Thank you.
Steve Paul is here. He's the arts editor and senior writer at the Kansas City Star. Stephen, good morning to you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me back.
Katie Stover is back. She's director of reader services for the Kansas City Public Library. Katie, good morning.
Pleasure to be here.
And Grace will also be here in just a few minutes. She's a writer and blogger. Well, how will 2012 rank as a year for good books? Any sort of general thoughts? How did we do this year, Stephen?
I think we did really well, surprisingly so, in the sense that, we keep hearing about the decline of the book and that sort of thing, but we ended up with a good book year. We just recently did our best of the year and, it was a strong year for fiction. There was a lot to choose from. There's always new titles, while there is disaster happening all around, industry manages to
perseveres.
Good things to read.
Okay, Stover, I love listening to you guys talk before the show. You guys get together, you all bring your stacks of books, and you're just talking and talking about all the good stuff that's out there. It's so fun to hear people excited about great books.
I think I brought a book with me today that I forgot to give Steve for my top 10.
Uh-oh.
And that's what I discover when I'm putting together my list of top 10. I always forget one or two really great titles that, like, oh, right, yes, that was wonderful. Well, now what comes off my list of top 10?
Yeah. Jeff?
I loved Alice Munro's Dear Life. I thought it was absolutely spectacular.
So we'll talk about it in just a bit.
The top of my top 10 for sure.
And if my wife's listening, it's coming to you here pretty soon here.
So, yeah. Merry Christmas.
How's that for a big surprise?
Spoiler alert.
Well, what makes a fictional character feel like a friend? That's how we promoted this show. Any general thoughts on that whole idea?
Well, a fictional character has to feel real to begin with. And whether it's a friend or someone you identify with is a question. Because not all fictional characters are people you want to be friends with, but you certainly want to be able to identify with them in some way, whether they're good or bad or whatever. And I can talk in terms of one of the novels, I was going to talk about today, Ian McEwan's new novel, where, the central character, a woman, it doesn't feel like somebody who I want to be friends with necessarily. And there are times she makes decisions that you just want to wring her neck and say, mm-hmm. no, don't do that. But that's because she feels real, not necessarily.
You bought her. Yeah.
Yeah. Not mm-hmm. necessarily that she's somebody I want to be friends with.
Yeah. Katie, how about you?
That was an interesting question, Steve. And I was thinking about that right before. And I realized that the one fictional character that I think kind of feels like a friend that I don't want as a friend is Olive Kittredge by Elizabeth Stout from a couple of years ago. And she's not very likable. But then there's a chapter in which you get to know her a little bit more and you understand her and you do like her a little bit. And she's curmudgeonly. She's irascible. She helps one teenage boy not commit suicide. She has no idea she's done that.
And she's real, to borrow
Steve
Paul's
word.
And
she's so real. That's what I loved about Olive Kittredge. This was someone that I thought, I probably know someone like this. I probably don't have too much interaction with her, which then jogs me to think, still waters run deep. I should probably pay a little bit more attention to those folks I think I don't want to spend time with, and maybe I do.
And she may or may not have reminded you that you are not a perfect person yourself.
Mm-hmm. There's that.
I would make an argument that one of the functions of fiction is to create sympathy and empathy mm-hmm. for others that we don't know and wouldn't have lunch with and wouldn't have coffee with.
Yeah. Grace?
Well, my favorite fictional character of this year is definitely Thomas Cromwell. From Hilary Mantel's two books, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies.
And he is because?
Oh, he's so charming and suave and humane and very, very complex and a deep person, and yet he's
describing
completely
me, Grace.
That's right, I am. And did I say handsome? Did I mention handsome?
Yeah. No, you hadn't, but now we've rectified that. Yeah.
Well, and actually, he's actually unlike you, completely unlike you. He's actually well known for being quite an ugly man. And in the Hans Holbein portrait of him in the Frick Museum, he's exceedingly homely. People said he looked like a toad, an evil toad, because he's also very venal. He's responsible for the death of dozens, if not hundreds, in England. And probably the most reviled and hated man of his time. And yet, I thought he was amazing. I would completely want to know him because the complexity of the portrait is that he does all of these completely evil, power-hungry things, and yet he himself is very gentle. He's very kind to his children. He's learned. He's cultured. He's a completely captivating character.
Well, that's a pretty good description of a compelling fictional character, that's for sure. Let's move on to our list here. We have lots of books and not a whole lot of time, but some time. Jeff, let's begin with Alice Munro. You've already teased us with her latest collection of short stories, which is titled Dear Life. You loved it.
Yeah, I did love it. And we talked about Alice Munro in general the last time we were on, but not this
talk
book
about her
in
enough,
particular,
though, really.
Which had not been published at that point. But this is a book of a collection of 14 stories, and the first 10 stories are not as dark as the stories in her last collection, ironically titled Too Much Happiness. These 10 stories feature characters lots of times who are straying from their marriage. The first story has a poet who's in a stale marriage, who's riding a train across the country to meet up with a newspaper columnist, and she meets an actor and leaves her young child in the railway car and goes and has a tryst. Then comes back, her child is not there. Finally finds her child between two railway cars on that shaking piece of metal, which kind of captures the sort of precarious, shaky place that she is. Because we're pressed for time, I'll skip ahead. The last part of the book is four autobiographical pieces.
Yeah, I've read about that, yeah.
And she has said, she's a Canadian author, she's 81 years old, as we all know. She has said that these are going to be the first and the last things that she has to say about her life. And it's not true that it's the first thing she has to say about her life, because she had an autobiographical collection, View from Castle Rock. We certainly hope it's not the last thing that she has to say about her life.
She did say she's going to stop writing after this.
I know she did. But
is it.
I'm not believing her about that.
How do writers do that?
But anyway, let me just tell you about this one piece of the autobiographical pieces. This is young Alice. She's had an emergency appendectomy, and she is, for that reason, let off the hook for the physical chores that go in the running of the farm. And she gets very restless. And she develops this obsessional fear that she's going to harm her younger sister. And so her younger sister sleeps in the bed beneath her. She loves her younger sister. So she starts walking all night to combat this, you know, because she's afraid to be alone with her sister. And one morning she comes in and her dad is waiting for her. And he said, having some trouble sleeping, huh? And she ends up confessing the whole thing to him, that she actually is fearful that she will strangle her younger sister. And he said, people have weird thoughts sometime, probably the effect of the ether, which just immediately relaxes her, this calm, wise acceptance, and she begins to sleep again. Now this is a guy who would also wail the daylights out of her for being too mouthy and sort of, you know, too big for her pants. So I would say that Alice Munro captures Dear Life in all of its complications,
and you couldn't recommend it enough. It doesn't sound like
best book I read last year.
Oh, that's terrific. Steve Paul,
what's going on?
All yours.
Well, I've got a stack of two or three or four stacks of books ahead of me. I will talk about Ian McEwan's new novel called Sweet Tooth, which I mentioned just a few minutes ago. McEwan is a British writer who I go hot and cold on over the years, but he's written some wonderful books, including Atonement. But Sweet Tooth is really, in some ways, rather unusual, and I liked it, and a lot of people are liking it. I have reason not to like it. There are aspects of it I'm not totally in love with, but it's about a young woman, daughter of a vicar who goes to Cambridge and is smart in math but really likes to read, and she reads lots of books and reads them fast, and she ends up in an affair with an older man, a professor, and then she, when she graduates, she is lured to MI5, the spy agency. This is 1960, late 1960s, early 1970s. It's a period when women just don't go very far in that world, and she knows it, but she, you know, she takes it and, you know, does it in secret. There's not much for her to do for quite a while except file and, you know, all those things that women do, you know, in that world. But soon an assignment comes along that is intriguing to her, and she bites, and it's the agency wants to fund writers and journals, literary journals, as a way to kind of carry the, you know, carry the values that they want to promote around the world. And this, of course, we know all about because of the CIA did the very thing in the 1950s with American writers and American journals and that sort of thing. So she gets involved in that project. She runs a writer named Tom Haley who, you know, I get the impression is not a very good writer, but she likes him, and he kind of goes off in different directions. But the tragedy is, of course, that she falls in love with a guy, and that, of course, creates conflict when his fiction kind of goes against what the agency would like to see happen, and then the apparent affair that's happening kind of against the wishes of her bosses, it caused some problems as well. So I guess I would say, you know, in some ways, as a central character, the woman is quite interesting. I'm not sure, you know, I think some readers may look at her as being a little too pliable and a little too easy to fall in love, you know, from certain perspectives. But again, this is the 60s. There's some interesting cultural context. There's some interesting, you know, names are dropped, writers' names are dropped. There's some historical Cold War background that makes the texture of the book pretty interesting. Well, it's a captivating read for the most part. Sweet Tooth by Ian McEwan.
Sounds great. Okay. Katie Stover, we're reviewing some of the latest good books with our book doctors here. Take us to one book here, The Books They Gave Me by Jen Adams.
The Books They Gave
Me. Or am I throwing you for a loop here? We're going to go somewhere else.
I would. I want to talk about
ahead.
What you want to do before you die,
what
since
you
teased
do before
the
you
listeners
die.
With that one.
Yeah.
This book I'm going to give to a 15-year-old boy on my list who says he doesn't want to read very much, but then says he does like to read. And this is 15-year-olds, a conundrum.
Oh, good luck.
It's by a collective of young men called The Buried Life, and it is a collection of 100 things they want to do before they die. And they
a bucket
made this,
list.
It's a bucket list, but it's an unusual bucket list. They've got their 100 things posted, first couple of pages, and at least 75 of them are crossed off. And what they've crossed off are crash the Playboy Mansion, longboard down a mountain, deliver a baby, give a stranger a $100 bill, take kids on a shopping spree. And so they've put all the evidence of all of those things in this book. But then they also solicited some other what do you want to do before you die moments from their readers. And there's some really poignant, funny things in here. There's one person wants to swing from a chandelier. One person wants to fly.
Been there, done that.
Have you?
You have not.
Time for a beer.
Yeah.
And then there's one lovely tribute. This one person wants to take his 96-year-old grandpa, who has been playing piano for 86 years, to see a symphony orchestra. There's some lovely what do you want to do before you die moments in this book. So I think it's going to resonate with this 15-year-old. And
you're paging through the book. It's very graphic.
It's very graphic.
And a lot of words on the pages that I'm looking at here.
You can think of it as similar to those post-secret books, except it's not so confessional. Mm-hmm. It's more aspirational. There's lots of wonderful artwork in here. People have crafted their submissions the way one would craft a post-secret submission. I talked about this book at a librarian's conference last summer and did one of the things in this book while I was talking about it, which is I want to say meow during a speech. So, and so I closed my chat with that. But this is a It just occurred to me this morning, this is the book I'm going to give to that hard-to-find 15-year-old on my list.
And the items that were crossed off, like Skateboard Down a Mountain, do they talk about those in the book? Or
they do. Yeah. There's everything they've crossed off is in here. So there's photographic evidence of them crashing the Playboy Mansion. They walked the red carpet. They weren't too picky about the red carpet, but they've got photos of them walking the red carpet. There's a photo of the one boy, Ben, holding the baby that he's just delivered. So everything that's crossed off on this list is in the book.
How old are these young authors?
Oh, I'll hold this up and you can just – they're all in their late 20s, early 30s. Okay. This is – they run a blog. I think it's called The Buried Life. And they're collectively known as The Buried Life, Johnny, Dave, Duncan, and Ben. And they just decided to do this. They're good writers. This is interesting writing they have here.
Well, Katie Stover, you just cost me $20 or $25. I'm making a note here.
Right,
I got a 14-year-old in mind for exactly what you're talking about there. That just sounds terrific. Yeah, good recommendation. Grace.
Well, I was going to go to my – hello. I was going to go to my favorite nonfiction book of the year, but since we're on gift ideas, I'd like to go to two other gift ideas that I have.
Yeah.
For the readers in your life, I loved this book called Unpacking My Library, and it's a perfect little gift book. It's very graphic. So it's 10 writers and pictures of their home libraries – and then pictures of their top 10 favorite books.
Oh, wow. That's a very cool idea.
Oh, it was fantastic.
That's
and it's
cool.
Really gratifying to see how people keep their books. And it's a little bit of nosiness. And also to see what people's favorite 10 books are, because it's really interesting. You would think that it would be, you know, all Shakespeare or Montaigne or something like that.
I hope not.
My 5-year-old son was really delighted to see that of the 10 authors, two of them list Tintin as their favorite, as one of their favorite top 10 books.
Oh,
and, you know, and he's a big...
Who are some of the writers that are reviewed here?
Alison Bechdel. So it's a really good mix who did the graphic novels that... what's the first one?
Fun Home.
And the one she did this year about her mother. Stephen Carter, Juno Diaz, Rebecca Goldstein, Jonathan Lethem, James Wood and Claire Massoud. Philip Pullman, whom a lot of teenagers like, Gary Steingart and Edmund White. So
oh,
a really
neat.
Great collection.
What a neat idea. A
it is a
idea.
Great gift idea. And since that one's a shorty, can I do my next gift
Please. Yeah.
book? This is a book that just came into my hands. And full disclosure, my friend is the editor here in the hometown press of Andrews McNeil.
Yeah.
But I had originally seen this artist in New York Magazine when Downton Abbey fever was at its height, and they did the Downton Abbey paper dolls on New York Magazine, and everybody adored it. Well, she had the brilliant idea of calling up the artist and saying, would you like to do a book? And so this is a spoof. They're very careful to say this is a spoof in no way associated with Downton Abbey. However, as you can see, the characters look exactly like. But instead of Bates, his name is Gates.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of Carson, it's Larson, et cetera. And the conceit is that Larson and Gates are secret agents in a kind of MI-15. And it's all, the whole Downton Abbey is a cover for this espionage operation. And, of course, the Dowager Countess with her glare, everyone is grabbing for this book because it's completely irresistible. The Dowager Countess's glare that she likes to cast on people is literally deadly. And so they each have this secret power, and hers is that glare. If you get on the wrong side of her, she will glare you to death. And it is hilarious, and it's so well done, and the characters look exactly alike, and it's a comic book. And for the Downton Abbey fans in your life, and there are a lot of them, this is the perfect gift.
I've got to add something to it because I just saw something recently that I really perked up at, but I haven't read it for 40 years. It's the 40th, and it's pertinent given the return of The Hobbit this week on screen. But 40 years ago, the folks at the National Lampoon did a book called Board of the Rings, and that has now been reissued in an anniversary edition and should be looked at for anybody who wants to.
Well, these are such good ideas.
Well, I've ordered 3 of these already.
And again, the title is?
The title is Agent Gates, and you'll be supporting your hometown company of Andrews McNeil.
I can't wait to read that.
Very good cause, yeah. Okay. Jeff, let's go to James Wood and How Fiction Works. How does fiction work?
Okay.
I love that retro cover. That's
incredible. Yeah, it's great. This is not a new book. This was published in 2008, and it says here it's the Kansas City Star Best Book of the Year for that year.
Steve Paul has an impact, whether he wants to or not.
A big footprint or fingerprint or anyway.
Small. Very small fingerprint.
James Wood is the fiction reviewer for a New Yorker magazine, and he teaches at Harvard half-time literary criticism. And this is a very erudite book. It's sort of a walk through postmodern literature. But the chapter that I liked the best was about sympathy and complexity in fiction. And he talks about a municipal president in a really rough area outside of Mexico City who devised a list of great literary works that his police force should read. And the police chief said that he thought that exposure to great literature would make the police officers more committed to upholding the principles that they should uphold.
That's an interesting idea.
And I think that this sort of defense or argument or persuasion for the power of literature and the transformative power of literature is really important. We were talking before the show. Kansas and Missouri are among 45 states who have adopted these Common Core standards that say that 70% of what is read in the English classroom should be informational. And, I mean, I've made a career out of writing nonfiction, but there are things that fiction can do for you that factual writing cannot. And what better time than when a child is young and coming of age and seminal education to sit them down and read the great literary works of the time. I first learned about those Common Core standards from my son's 10th grade English teacher, because she is going to be hard-pressed to find room to shoehorn in a Shakespeare play this year in her 10th grade English class. Now, apparently, the framers of these standards have backed away from it and said, you know, these are not required. You know, these are guidelines. On the other hand, they are crafting tests that will be given in 2014 and 2015 that will reflect the emphasis on nonfiction. And I think it's a move in the wrong direction.
So hopefully Kansas City, Missouri Police Chief Daryl Forte is listening and maybe picked up a good idea here.
Yeah.
Interesting idea. Okay. Steve Paul, Richard Barnett.
We could talk about that real quick.
Yeah.
This is a fun book for somebody on your list who has a propensity to imbibe.
Mm.
But it's a wonderful little history called The Book of Gin. And the subtitle being A Spirited History from Alchemist Stills and Colonial Outposts to Gin Palaces, Bathtub Gin, and Artisanal Cocktails. This is a history, and it's a very nice history. I will say at times it feels like a little dry history, but it traces the origins of and alchemists and others who discovered the pleasures of the oil of the juniper berry and other substances that were substituted for it in the beginning of the 16th, 17th century. Gin became this cause célèbre and sort of a mark of kind of evil, bad things among poor people in London. And so it's had this sort of social class history, and but also a history of pleasure and this thing that has kind of been with us as liquor does today for us. It leads to bad things and it leads to pleasure, and so that history is strong, and this book presents it. There's a period of prohibition in the 19th century, and then they came out of it, and then we, of course, had our prohibition in the 1920s. But bathtub gin, of course, was how regular folks got around it. Today, you may or may not know that there's a gin revival going on the last 5 or 10 years, when all sorts of kind of young producers of boutique gins have popped up across the land, and there's sort of a return to kind of the pleasures of gin as kind of the spirit of choice.
I'm trying to think if I want to make gin in my bathtub.
You know, I would. If you make it strong enough, you might be okay.
Yeah,
but
survive it.
Yeah. So
clean the bathtub first.
So as cultural history, as food history, it's a pretty solid book, and it's a British. You know, it's certainly. Oriented to British readers, but it is it's quite good. Richard Barnett, The Book of Gin. I'll toast it.
Okay, that's a very good list. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our book doctors. We have a whole bunch of other good books to talk about, and later on this hour, the debut of our new series, 90 Mile View. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. If you missed yesterday's discussion about CPR, the Royals pitcher trade, and the New York Times obituaries, you can find them and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, does your family drive you nuts? Are your holidays rife with tension? We'll talk with psychologist Harriet Lerner about dealing with the relative tension of the festive season. Coming up this hour, we're talking with our book doctors, and Katie Stover's up next. She wants to talk about The Books They Gave Me by Jen Adams.
Yes, I have another bookie book like Grace does. Mine does not come with charming photos like hers does. This book, The Books They Gave Me by Jen Adams, you give this one to the bookworm on your list. It's just a collection of stories and gift tags about books that were given as gifts by their readers. And some of these tags go from, you know, gaggy to gags. There's the couple who each gave each other Ulysses. They were in a long-term relationship and realized a couple months later that neither of them were reading it. And they just couldn't finish it, and they just gave up. And they were despairing of telling the other one because they thought that would cause them to break up. Or the 30-year-old who gave a teenager Lolita. Bad choice of a gift book. It's a really delightful mixtape of the stories behind the stories that we give as gifts.
The Books They Gave Me by Jen Adams,
And then I brought Cruel by Jennifer Albin. She's a local author, since we're talking about our favorite locals. Mm-hmm. And I know she was on your show not too long ago. But this one I'm giving to the special 14-year-old in my life. I'm giving her this book. She's insatiable. And it's about a young girl who spins the web of the world with another group of women called spinsters. This is one of those dystopian YA novels. And it's just taking off. It's the first in a trilogy. And this young girl controls the threads of human life. And this great responsibility also includes snipping the loose threads of family and friends. So what's near and dear to librarians' hearts about this book, Cruel, by Jennifer Albin, is that Jennifer wrote it during NaNoWriMo, and she wrote it using library computers. So this one's a favorite of ours. So
very
that's
good.
Cruel by Jennifer Albin.
All right. Grace, how about 1616?
Let's
go back a few
book.
Years.
Yeah, exactly. I just started it, so I'm only halfway through. But it concentrates on the year 1616, which is such a fascinating period in time. First of all, both Shakespeare and Cervantes died that year, and so it is the height of the Renaissance, but kind of the end of the old world. The age of exploration is in full boom. And the world looks so different than what we think of it now. For instance, the greatest power in Europe, you know, I think that our culture is such an Anglo-centric one.
Mm-hmm.
We assume that England was always the height. But the greatest power in this time is Spain, because it has this incredible riches from the silver mines of Mexico and Bolivia, something we don't think about.
Yeah, right.
And it's the Mughal Empire in India. It's the height of Persia and the Ottoman Empire. The countries that we think of in Europe do not exist as such. It's a bunch of city-states, And the Holy Roman Empire, which, as the author says, is triply misnamed, being neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. And it's fascinating stuff. For instance, an Englishman named, I think, James Ward, who converts to Islam. We don't think about that either, the power of Islam in those days. And goes down to northern Africa. And you don't think of people traveling these great distances and being immigrants. And becomes a famous corsair pirate who kidnaps people from other ships because there's so much sea traffic. And I also did not know that Cervantes was kidnapped by these corsair pirates and worked as a slave for 5 years. And so it's this fascinating. Wow. The
look at a world you didn't know much about.
Yes, and all the cultural exchanges that we don't think about because we are very Eurocentric. And so the fact that all these Persian artists learned from Chinese artists and were influenced by the Chinese art, and that was the great artistic influence of the world at that time.
That book is 1616 by?
By Thomas Christensen.
Thomas Christensen, okay. Jeff Ann Gowdy, let's go to Dan Savage and The Commitment.
Okay, Dan Savage is the author of the popular sex column Savage Love, which actually I only read one of, and I'm not prudish, but my eyes got as big as saucers.
You couldn't get
them
back.
I'm living on this planet. Anyway, yeah. Same planet here. A dear friend, Harriet Lerner, gave me this book to read, and I read it last year on a road trip. And Savage is also the founder of the It Gets Better video project for to counteract bullying of young gays who are coming of age, and is a wildly funny writer. And this book is about, it was published in 2006, I think, in the year 2005, when he didn't want to get married, and his partner, Terry, doesn't want to get married, and his very conventional, in some ways, young son doesn't want his two dads to get married. He doesn't think it's necessary. But Dan Savage's mother is a Catholic mom, and her children are all unmarried with children. And by golly, this kid is going to get married, even though he's in a same-sex relationship. So he buckles under, and he and his partner, by the end of the book, go to Canada and get married, despite the fact they're really mad because their marriage has no legal standing in Washington State. Mm-hmm. Of course, the happy postscript to this is that as of Sunday, Dan Savage and his partner, Terry Miller, are legally married, and they got married in the free City Hall ceremony that he helped organize.
Wow.
And he always used to have to go around and introduce Terry Miller as his boyfriend in the United States, but his husband in Canada, and now he can say his husband. So the glacier moves slowly.
Yes, it does. That's Dan Savage's new book, The Commitment.
Actually,
right?
It's an old book.
Older book.
Yeah,
okay. The Commitment. All right. Steve Paul.
I'm going to give a shout out to
the Kansas City Star.
Yeah, I'm going to give a shout out to a brand new book put out by locals. It's called The Whirlybird Anthology of Kansas City Writers. And edited by Vernon Rowe, Mary Frances Wagner, David and Judy Ray. The book is a collection of poetry, prose by numerous writers, many of whom live here in Kansas City, many of whom pass through these parts at one time or another in the past, and left a wide, various collection of words. And it's an impressive collection. I must disclose, I have a poem in it, but a very small slice of what is a large book of much more interesting writers than me. And, you know, people like James Tate, who came out of Kansas City, actually the secret, I think, is that he's from Raytown, but, you know, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. He's here with some early poems. I was impressed by the fact that the book begins with some poems by Ernest Hemingway, and I've always sort of poo-pooed Hemingway's poetry as being kind of bad, but these are well chosen, and I was reminded that a few of Hemingway's 88 poems are actually pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
There's poetry by contemporary writers like Wayne Miller and Bob Stewart and Michel Boisseau, B.H. Fairchild, H.C. Palmer, and I just think they did a very nice job putting this this book together. And
it's called The Whirlybird.
It's called The Whirlybird, and that's the name of the press.
Ah.
that Vernon Rowe operates.
With a big picture of downtown Kansas City on the cover.
It's a nice big book for a value price at $15 paperback, and I hope it does well.
Yeah, great idea.
Okay. Library will be getting copies.
Good.
Katie Stover from the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library.
Yes, I have two left, but I definitely want to talk about Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore by Robin Sloan. This is the book I accidentally left off my top 10 that I sent to Steve.
Shame on you.
Yes, I'm really disappointed. It's wonderful in audio as well as print. And it's about a young clerk in a bookstore who services a clientele who don't ever buy anything. They check the books out from the bookstore, and they seem to be looking for the answers to some mysterious puzzle, and the young clerk uses his computer to put together all the information that these clients are checking out, and he solves the puzzle in a very short amount of time. And what he learns is that there's even more to this puzzle. It's actually what is the answer to immortality. And so he and his girlfriend, who work at Google, start to investigate where the crossroads between books and technology meet, and how does that answer the question of how do we become immortal? And that's really a small part of it. This is a book that is actually using, as a trope, the quest from a high fantasy novel. They put together a modern band of warriors and wizards and, you know, rogues, and Robin Sloan has just updated the stereotypical characters from a high fantasy novel. He's just plopped them in New York, and he's using Google as one of their set pieces, and a bookstore. And this is not a book that comes down on the side of technology or print. It's showing how they live together. It's a book for people who are afraid, oh, books are going to fall by the wayside. No. And it's a book for folks who really want to know, well, how is technology going to enhance our lives, and how does technology make what we're doing better, make us smarter?
And you haven't mentioned the most important thing about Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, which is the cover.
The
glows
cover
in the dark.
Glows in the dark.
Now, why does it do that?
Robin Sloan in an interview said that you need to do something to make your book stand out.
And he found it.
So he found it. And the one you're all looking at here is my galley, which is black. And I know it doesn't glow in the dark because I've walked into a closet with it. But the one that's at the bookstores has a yellow and white cover, and you take that into the dark and it glows this really awesome green cover.
So Robin Sloan has found the secret to best-selling success here, it
yes.
sounds like.
Yeah. Really fast-paced book, too.
Yeah.
Good one for teens.
We're visiting with our book doctors this morning. Grace Suh, what else you got there?
Well, I think I'm going to do the book Amsterdam by Geert.
I think you should do that book.
And you ask, why should anybody read a book about Amsterdam?
This is from a few years ago, too. This is
that's
not
right.
A new
I think
book.
It's 2008. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And why should anybody read a book about Amsterdam? And that's because in its heyday, in its golden age, Amsterdam was the New York of its time. It was even, you could say, the America of its time, because it was the place where everybody immigrated. Mm-hmm. And it was the place that was the beacon of freedom. I mean, we all know that's where the pilgrims went on their way to America to escape from religious persecution. It's where all the Jews went from the Iberian Peninsula, escaping the Inquisition. It was the economic power of its time. It was the birth of the first transnational company that issued stocks.
I'm getting the impression you just want to go back and live a few centuries ago.
I am reading a lot of history these days.
They were making gin there, too.
I really love history, and so I've been reading a lot of history. But I just want to read this funny little Well, and the other reason why we shouldn't read about Amsterdam and Holland is because our country is so influenced by Amsterdam. I mean, New York was originally New Amsterdam. And New
That's
York
right.
and our country is so much more like New Amsterdam than it is like the country the pilgrims would have founded, because the pilgrims escaped from religious intolerance and established here one of the most religiously intolerant colonies in the world.
Okay.
Whereas in New York, New Amsterdam, everybody was welcome to come.
Mm-hmm.
There were the first synagogue is there. You know, there were Jews, there were Islam. And in Amsterdam, there were people from Turkey, people from China, people escaping wars in Poland. And
you are just enlightening me by the second here. Just almost more information.
I consider it my mission.
So. Yeah.
But I'm going to read you this little, this funny little, as a former New Yorker, longtime New Yorker, I found this hilarious. This is a report, the first report of what we now know as the island of Manhattan. The meadows are rich with grass and flowers and trees, and lovely fragrances are wafted around. And so they were just, this is the report saying we should go, you know, start a city there because it's just a verdant fairyland.
Well, that's a great book to end on. Amsterdam from 2008. The author is?
Geert Mak.
Okay. Well, I'm going to thank our book doctors, as always, for coming in and offering up so many good ideas here. Grace, Jeff and Gowdy, Steve Paul and Katie Stover, thank you all and happy holidays. So good to have you all.
Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks. Pleasure.